That's Motion Trio. And they're a Polish, they're a trio of accordions. And they're really wonderful. Sometimes they're really kind of hypnotic and stuff and interesting. But that about does it for today, Radio Free Chico. You want to stay tuned momentarily for Peace and Social Justice. Randy Larson is here. He's going to be your host. So stay tuned. And I'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Ray Lager, Underwriting Director here at KZFR. I'd like to invite you to consider shopping with KZFR Underwriters First. Whether it's for retail items, goods or services, or a night on the town, shopping with our underwriters makes your dollar go further. First, you get what you want, and we get a strong base of KZFR underwriters. For a complete list of our underwriters, visit KZFR.org and click on the Underwriters tab, and let the businesses know that you heard about them on 90.1 KZFR, the Zephyr. Keep it live, keep it local, right here on KZFR.
This is the Peace and Social Justice program. I want to tell you it's being underwritten this hour by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Chico Downtown Business Association, supporting downtown Chico for over 40 years now. The CDBA brings you the Thursday night markets, the Friday night concert series, A Taste of Chico, the Christmas preview and the tree lighting, the Tree Street, and a whole long list of other things that happen throughout the year. If you'd like a full schedule of what's happening downtown associated with the CDBA, you can visit downtownchico.com and help keep Chico vibrant by shopping local and coming downtown. And by Opathecary Options, a compounding pharmacy specializing in bioidentical hormone replacement for women and testosterone replacement for men. If you'd like more information, you can give them a call at 345-7979, 345-7979, or at APOTHECARYOptions.com. Coming up on the program, we have a couple of things that we're going to be focusing on this morning. In about an hour, we'll be talking with Catherine Phillips, and she is the director of Sierra Club California, and she's in her office in Sacramento today. And we're going to be talking with her about the EPA and Scott Pruitt, who is the man that Donald Trump has put up for confirmation to head up the EPA, and we're going to be talking about the concerns that Sierra Club California and Sierra Club National has with Scott Pruitt heading up the EPA. And I'll give you a little hint. He has made a career of trying to eliminate the EPA, so somewhat an unlikely person to head it. We'll be talking with Catherine Phillips about that. And coming up in just 5 minutes or so, we're going to be talking with Dr. Shay Wolf. She's a climate science director for the Center of Biological Diversity. And the United States Fish and Wildlife Service issued on Monday their polar bear recovery plan. plan for the polar bear up in the Arctic. And Dr. Wolf is the person who, 12 years ago, first filed the petition to list the polar bear as an endangered species. So we're going to talk to her about what she thinks of this Fish and Wildlife Service polar bear recovery plan and what that has to do with justice for our furry friends in the wilderness world. So we'll be back with her. We'll be back with Dr. Shea Wolf after we take a real quick break.
When we're living in the White House and debating on the hills, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants, and Old Glory will be fertile. 'Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world. And a bill will be proposed, section number one. We're shutting down the oil rigs and turning towards the sun. The air will be clean for all the boys and girls, 'cause we don't want your oil tankers, we just want the world. Face the executioner, shut the logging camps all down. Get busy planting hemp, leave the trees there in the ground. Life is too precious on this little spinning pearl, 'cause we don't want your bulldozers, we just want the world. We'll be closing down the jails and fixing up the schools, distributing those stocks and bonds, changing all the rules. We'll elect a CEO, maybe a rabbit or a squirrel, 'cause we don't want your money, we just want the world. Be swimming in the rivers and running to the hills, reading in the history books of wars and oil spills. If it's linear, we'll bend it. If it's a straight line, it'll curl. 'Cause we don't want your dead-end highway, we just want the world. When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants, and Old Glory will be fertile. 'Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world. Got on TV and repeated the big lie. See the mill all boarded up, hear the sympathetic sigh. He summed it up succinctly with these vicious words: it's your paycheck or your planet, the loggers of the birds. Pete Wilson and his cronies were nowhere to be found. They said big timber is our business, to the dollar we are bound. Their absence was a message, we'll turn a blinded eye. Don't expect us to give a damn if anyone should die. Charles Hurwitz told the nation, the battle lines are drawn. These eco-terrorists won't stop till all your jobs are gone. His PR team worked overtime to build up every wall. These bomb throwers and tree spikers just want to kill you all. A man stood at the chainsaw, knowing only what he knew. And everything he learned said, it's either me or you. His saw lanced through the redwood, many hateful words he said. And several seconds later, David Chain was lying dead.
Hey, welcome back to the program. This is Randy Larson in the Peace and Social Justice program. We're going to be talking with Shay Wolf. She is the Climate Science Director for the Center of Biological Diversity. She works with the Center's Climate Law Institute. Dr. Wolf graduated with a bachelor's in biology from Yale and then a PhD from Ecology and Evolutionary Biology from the University of California at Santa Cruz. And she has a long list of activism credentials, been working for years doing all sorts of wonderful stuff, including some work with Conservación de Islas in Mexico. And she's worked as a wildlife biologist, working with seabirds and songbirds and raptors and spiders in Panama and goodness knows what else. We're quite blessed to have Dr. Wolf with us on the program today. Hi, Shay. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show.
So Shay, it was, was it just Monday, I guess, that the Fish and Wildlife Service released their recovery plan for the polar bear in the Arctic? Is that right? Was it on Monday?
That's right. The polar bear has been protected as a threatened species since 2008 because of climate change, because of the rapid loss of its Arctic sea ice habitat. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has been working on a recovery plan for quite some time, and they finally released the final plan on Monday.
And you were one of the people who petitioned for the polar bear to be protected as an endangered species some 12 years ago, I guess, right?
That's right. In 2005, a colleague of mine at the Center for Biological Diversity, Cassie Siegel, who is a tireless advocate for wildlife, she petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to protect the polar bear as endangered because of the threat of climate change.
So what was really interesting about this is that the Secretary of the Interior at the time, Dirk Kempthorne, he was working with the George Bush administration and agreed to list the polar bear. So if the Bush administration was on board, one might be able to assume that the polar bear was in fact in trouble.
That's right, and that's a really key point. So that listing happened during the Bush administration, when many folks at the Fish and Wildlife Service weren't even allowed to talk about climate change. And one of the beauties of the Endangered Species Act that the bear is protected under is that most decisions need to be based on science. And so government scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey produced a series of reports, and in those reports they said, look, if we don't make deep cuts in greenhouse gas pollution, we project that two-thirds of the world's polar bears will be gone by mid-century, by 2050. And so that provided when the government's own scientists are saying, wow, these bears are really in peril, then Dirk Kempthorne was obligated to protect the bear, even though he was very clear that he did not want to do so.
That's really interesting, isn't it? So he's in a position where he feels like he has to do something, almost forced to do it because of the preponderance of evidence coming from the scientific community.
That's right. Mm.
So one of the things that I really want to hone in on here is this interesting kind of dichotomy within the recovery plan that the Fish and Wildlife Service has issued. Because they say right in this recovery plan that unless we deal with global warming, which is one of the main causes of problems for the polar bear, that we're probably not going to be able to actually help the polar bear, that we really need to focus in on global warming. But the recovery plan itself doesn't take that step in a very forceful way. Is that right? Is what I just said correct? And if so, how do you explain that?
Yeah, that is correct. And that's a really big problem with this plan. It's just not strong enough. It just doesn't go far enough to protect polar bears. Because, as you said, the plan acknowledges that we have to, the U.S. has to make deeper cuts in greenhouse gas pollution to save the polar bear, that we can do all of these other things to try and help. But unless the U.S. and the world makes aggressive cuts in greenhouse gas pollution to keep global temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius, we're not on the path to do that right now. Unless we make more aggressive cuts, that we're going to lose the world's polar bears. But yet, in the cornerstone of the recovery plan, the key steps are silence on greenhouse gas pollution. So, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service identified the problem, the key problem for the polar bear, but failed to make the key solution as part of the strategy for recovering the bear, the polar bear. And it also, you know, one other aspect of the plan that's quite disturbing is that it allows for an 85% decline in the global polar bear population. And it says, you know, even if there's an 85% decline, we'll still consider polar bears recovered. And that's just unacceptable. But I think, you know, there's kind of number of reasons for why the Fish and Wildlife Service...
So, Shay, not to cut you off, but just to kind of jump in enthusiastically here for a second. When we're talking about an 85% decline in the number of polar bears, we're starting with what, 22,000 polar bears, something like that? What is the present population?
About that, you know, polar bears are hard to count in the wild because they're out there up in the, you know, Arctic on the sea ice, but it's about, around 22,000 to 23,000 bears. And in Alaska, there are two polar bear populations that number probably about 2,000 to 3,000 polar bears.
Do you have any sense of what they were historically?
Yeah, you know, they were much larger. There was many more historically, and then polar bears suffered a huge decline because of hunting and poaching. And then we got this International Polar Bear Protection Agreement in the 1970s that really helped bears recover. So polar bear numbers, you know, were increasing and polar bears were doing better, and then they've been hard hit, unfortunately, by carbon pollution, by climate change melting their sea ice.
So let me see if I'm understanding this correctly. So we're talking about maybe 22,000 polar bear, and they've already been listed as endangered. The recovery plan says that we can lose 85% of this 22,000. And if we do that, the polar bear will be deemed recovered?
Yeah, I mean, the plan, you know, obviously we don't, you know, doesn't want to see those losses. I mean, no one wants to see those losses in polar bears. But it said, you know, look, if polar bears continue to climb as they have been, and even if they get down to these very low levels,
4,000 or so.
Yeah.
They're saying they're, that it's, so what does the word recovered mean?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, recovered, it should be, you know, healthy polar bear populations where there are, you know, enough, there are sufficient numbers, and they're in enough places where they can, they can have a good chance of, or, you know, very strong chance of surviving and doing well. And, you know, reducing the global population by 85% is simply not going to allow for healthy polar bear populations.
Well, not if they're already considered endangered.
Yes. So, yes. So that's another key problem of the plan. That's been, you know, very disappointing.
So back to this thing about about global warming. So one of the co-chair persons of the recovery team tells this story about the polar bear's plight and the connection that plight has with climate warming. And she says, this is a quote, "In order to recover polar bears, we believe that we have to address the climate change problem over the long run. Short of action that effectively addresses the primary cause of diminishing sea ice, which is, you know, global warming, it's unlikely that the polar bear will be recovered." So it isn't as if the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't recognize and even identify the primary cause of the depletion of the polar bear.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, what the Fish and Wildlife Service said in terms of justifying why they're not making greenhouse gas pollution reductions the cornerstone of the plan is that they say, you know, we don't have direct authority to regulate greenhouse gas pollution, therefore we're not making it part of the key steps to recover the polar bear. But that's a straw man, because the duty of the Fish and Wildlife Service in creating this recovery plan is to lay out the steps that it and other federal agencies can take to protect the polar bear, to allow it to survive. And there are other federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency that have very clear authority to regulate greenhouse gas pollution under the Clean Air Act, for example. And the Fish and Wildlife Service's job in this plan is to tell the truth, to communicate to other agencies, hey, Environmental Protection Agency, when you're creating your rules about reducing, you know, carbon pollution from power plants, you need to take into account many things, you know, the danger that climate change poses to people, but also to wildlife. So they need to be communicating, hey, without rapid reductions, bigger cuts in greenhouse gas pollution, many of our wildlife species are not going to survive. And so that is a problem that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't communicate that in the plan, even though they know that greenhouse gas cuts are the key to saving the species.
Do you think they considered communicating this in the plan?
You know, I think so. I mean, we've been doing, you know, a lot of back and forth with the Fish and Wildlife Service over the years on this issue. And I think that it was considered and unfortunately rejected. It was a very big missed opportunity for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
And rejected simply because they argue that it's out of their jurisdiction to be telling the EPA what to do?
Yeah, even though that's not the case, they have a duty under the Endangered Species Act to be working with other agencies when those agencies do things that might jeopardize endangered species in this country, there's an obligation for the Fish and Wildlife Service to work with those agencies to communicate that fact and to work with the agencies on trying to do better on those rules and regulations.
Now, do you know what Dirk Kempthorne said back in 2008 about the role of climate change with the plight of the polar bear?
Yeah, you know, my memory is that there's in the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision on the polar bear when they decided to list it, that they really, in that decision, they really don't talk about greenhouse gases causing climate change very much in that plan. They just kind of say, oh, you know, the sea ice is disappearing and that's a problem for the polar bear and therefore we're listing it, but they don't, do their job and kind of really talking about the causes of that sea ice loss.
Mm.
So that's changed. I mean, under the Obama administration, of course, there's been, much more action and conversation and communication about climate change. So that's changed in the agency.
Mm-hmm. But we're still dealing with these issues in a piecemeal approach.
Yes. And there's still much more, you know, that on climate change that, you know, could have and should have been done under the Obama administration. And, you know, unfortunately, this is one example of that.
Well, if everything goes according to Trump's plan, we're going to have a new EPA director, Scott Pruitt, who believes that the EPA, let alone the Fish and Wildlife Service, shouldn't be dealing with issues of climate change. Is that discouraging?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the nomination of Scott Pruitt and Rex Tillerson for the Secretary of State, you know, the Exxon's CEO, is very dangerous and disturbing because of, you know, the importance, the absolute, you know, critical importance of working on climate change right now. You know, we don't have time to waste. And the fact that Scott Pruitt is a climate denier and has worked closely with the fossil fuel industry as Oklahoma's Attorney General is very disturbing when he is supposed to oversee an agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, that's supposed to protect people exactly from carbon pollution, from other toxins. And, Scott Pruitt has worked to undermine, you know, the work of the very agency that he has been nominated to lead. He's sued the Environmental Protection Agency many times over their regulations that are meant to protect Americans from toxins, you know, from ozone, from mercury, from contaminated water. So it's a very disturbing nomination. I hope a lot of people, maybe some of your listeners, will call their senators, help people around the country will speak out.
Well, I think he's probably a perfect nomination coming from Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has said all along that he wants to get rid of the EPA in almost every form, he says. He says, we are going to have little tidbits left.
Yeah.
So what do you do? What do you do with that? What do you as a climate scientist do with that? You just put your head down and keep on plugging?
No, no way. I mean, I think that's a dangerous response. I think that scientists and, you know, citizens alike need to be speaking out and standing up. And so, you know, politicians are actually very influenced by calls in particular from their constituents. And so when people call into the senators and say, hey, we want you to impose a nomination, for example, of Scott Pruitt for EPA or Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, you know, they listen, and it does make a difference. And you know, additionally, there's other things that I think people can do. I mean, the public voice is very, very important, and people should not underestimate their power to express, you know, their concerns and their unwillingness to accept, you know, unacceptable things and to make change. So I think, you know, part of the work will be, you know, if Scott Pruitt, for example, does, you know, get approved, and I hope that doesn't happen, you know, he will, you know, he's vowed to, and he will you know, try and reduce the effectiveness of the agency, you know, perhaps, you know, cut its budget, try and prevent it from following through on its responsibilities. But we do have the courts as a backstop. I mean, an agency can't all of a sudden with a change of administration say, hey, you know, we're not going to follow through on our regulations, you know, without, you know, well, we're going to repeal or, you know, revoke these regulations without some good explanation. You can't just say, oh, I don't like it, and I'm going to revoke this regulation. And they have to have some kind of good explanation. And that gets weighed out in court. So I think there's some opportunities in the courts to really fight, you know, some of the rollbacks that we're going to see in terms of, you know, the legislation, the important laws that are on the books.
So let me just circle back around. So if we get in this Fish and Wildlife Service plan that came out earlier this week, saying the polar bear is in trouble, saying one of the main causes of the polar bear being in trouble is melting ice due to climate change, if the EPA is the organization which is at least in large part responsible for dealing with this, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is not asking for the EPA's help specifically, at least not in the core of the plan. What if they had asked for the EPA to get involved, but the EPA that's getting involved is the Scott Pruitt EPA? Mm-hmm. Does that seem like a place where you really want to pass the baton?
Right, right. You know, I think that Under a Trump administration, you know, we're also worried about, you know, the Brian Zinks, who is the nominee for choice for Interior Secretary that oversees the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, public land protection and wildlife protection, because he has been very vocally against the against the Endangered Species Act. So I think, you know, there's multiple problems. There's you know, problems with these political appointees that will head the agencies. But, you know, there's some hope because the core staff of the agencies, you know, doesn't change. It's usually the top level. So you still have a lot of people in these agencies, in the Environmental Protection Agency, in Fish and Wildlife Service, that really care and want to follow the law, want to protect our climate, want to protect wildlife. And so part of the work will be to help empower and enable those people to do their good work by fighting, you know, some of the rollbacks that will happen at the highest levels in court, by expressing, you know, our public opinion that that's not okay for us. We don't want wildlife like the polar bear to go extinct. We don't want to be in the climate jeopardy that we're in now, where we're seeing, you know, rising sea levels and melting Arctic sea ice and coral reefs collapsing and extreme weather. But that's not okay. That we demand more. We demand that the Environmental Protection Agency do its job. So I think there's just a lot of work to be done in the next 4 years. And, you know, I hope everybody is, you know, really interested and energized in doing that, because it's going to take us all. It's going to, you know, take people raising their voices to make some change here.
It's straight up 12 o'clock. You're listening to KZFR Chico. My name is Randy Larson. We're talking with Dr. Shea Wolf. She is a climate science director with the Center for Biological Diversity. Shea, there's so many other critters that are in trouble right now. The walrus, you mentioned the coral reefs, the emperor penguins, the pika, one of my favorite little critters, cutest little thing you'll ever see. Flying squirrels here in California, down in San Bernardino. How would you assess the general relationship that the United States government is having with endangered species? I guess that's a pretty large question, but just in terms of the general political will associated with endangered species, do you think endangered species are getting a fair voice in this? Do you think that they're being pushed to the side? How important do you think endangered species are to the political will?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, the attention that endangered species get from, you know, the government really fluctuates depending on who is in charge. So during the Bush administration, we, you know, that the Fish and Wildlife Service that oversees endangered species protection was really underfunded, and they barely got anything done because they were told from the top, you know, don't do this. Don't continue to protect species under the act. Don't follow through on, you know, the habitat protections and recovery plans that these species need. And so very little got done. And, you know, our organization, for example, during that time was very active in the courts, you know, saying, you know, hey, you have a responsibility under the law. These laws are, you know, are passed or have very strong support from all Americans. People don't want endangered species to go extinct. So you need to do your job. And, you know, we had a lot of wins in the court, you know, forcing the agency to do its job, for example, forcing the agency to make the decision on the polar bear. And under the Obama administration, things have been better. But, you know, wildlife was not, and endangered species were not one of President Obama's priorities. You know, we still got many more species protected under the Endangered Species Act under Obama than under Bush. And we made some strides forward, but there were also problems. Many species that did not get protection that deserved it. So I think, you know, one of the key problems is that the Fish and Wildlife Service is not, doesn't have the budget and the staff that it needs to do its job to protect wildlife. And I think that's one key area that really needs to be improved, is that the agency itself needs to call for a bigger budget, say, hey, you know, this is what we have to do to protect America's wildlife species from going extinct. We need this budget. We need the staff. And they haven't been doing that. That's one area for improvement.
Shea, can you give us an example or two of animals that you think deserve protection but didn't receive it?
Yeah, so the American wolverine. I don't know if people are familiar with wolverines. We do have one in the Sierra Nevada. We used to have many. They were hunted.
We have one wolverine?
Yes, we have one in California, Sierra Nevada. We used to have many. They were hunted down to virtual extinction. We have one that's come in from the northern areas, and his name is Buddy.
We have one wolverine. Individual wolverine, Buddy.
Buddy is
a loner. That's a silly name. He's a loner. He doesn't have a buddy.
Yes, that is a silly name because he is waiting for a mate. He is looking for a mate. He is waiting for some company, and he doesn't have it yet.
We should call him a loner.
Yes. Well, most wolverines are in the kind of northern part of the state, of the country, in the Rockies. And they are very imperiled by climate change. Well, wolverines need to build snow dens during the winter to give birth and rear their kits. So the snow dens provide this protective insulation like an igloo for the moms and their kits. And so we have very few wolverines in the United States, probably around 300 or so. There used to be many more. And so not only are there already these very small depleted populations compared to historical levels, but they are now endangered by climate change melting the snowpack that they need to build their snow dens. and the Fish and Wildlife Service was going to protect the American wolverine under the Endangered Species Act, but then last minute, a regional director said, no, I don't think so. It's my opinion that it doesn't deserve listing, even though her own scientists and a independent scientific review panel said, yes, there's, you know, there's such strong evidence that the species is threatened and needs listing. So she reversed the decisions of her scientists and said, no, we're not going to protect the wolverine. That decision was fought in court, and this year there was a very good decision. The court said, hey, this looks very political. You know, several states, western states, like Wyoming, Idaho, didn't want listing. The judge said, this looks very political, redo the decision. This is not okay. And so right now the Fish and Wildlife Service is redoing the decision, but unfortunately now it's going to be redone under the Trump administration. So, you know, it's probably another legal battle coming up when the wolverine gets denied protection again.
So if the wolverine has, if there's 300 wolverines, what is the, I mean, that seems to me kind of on the face of it, pretty good evidence that the critter is endangered. What's the counter argument? Why would they say no?
Yeah, you know, what they said no, they acknowledged, you know, that the small population size was a problem, but they said no. They said, oh, you know, the climate science, the science is too uncertain to really know what's going to happen with snowpack and with, you know, snowpack reduction and with and its effects on the wolverine. And what the judge said was, hey, look, this decision needs to be based on the best available science and the studies out there, studies explicitly, you know, addressing the fact that the wolverine was going to be, is being and was going to be imperiled by climate change. And so we've got to rely on the best available science, and the scientists are telling us that there's a big problem here. We don't have to have ironclad certainty. You know, we give the benefit of the doubt to the species. There's enough science here, enough information to go ahead and protect the wolverine. So the service, Fish and Wildlife Service, is saying there's too much uncertainty. The judge and we definitely disagreed with that.
Well, what are they uncertain about? I mean, are they uncertain about the numbers?
They're uncertain. They said that they were uncertain about the rate of snowpack loss and how it affects the wolverine.
Mm-hmm. So the American wolverine, we got one. We got one guy named Buddy hanging out somewhere in the Sierra Nevada. Where did Buddy come from? Do you know?
Probably from the Rockies. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think Buddy will find a partner?
I hope so. I mean, I hope so. One of the conservation activities that would have flowed from the listing would probably have been reintroduction of wolverines into the Sierra Nevada so that Buddy would have some company. There's really good habitat for them there. And a lot of opportunity. We used to have wolverines in California, and we still could, but they need some help because there's such a big distance between California and the populations to the north. It's really hard for wolverines to cross our road enmeshed, you know, developments, you know, impacted landscape to actually get to the Sierra Nevada.
Mm-hmm. There's no real wildlife corridor for the wolverine.
Not much. Place for them, right?
What happened to the so you're familiar with this timber wolf that was roaming around in Northern California a couple of years ago and ended up finding a mate and having some pups? That's a relatively recent development.
That's right, and that was really exciting. I know a lot of people across California were very excited about the prospects of wolves recolonizing California, and I think that it will happen. You know, the state did decide to protect wolves, so under the State Endangered Species Act, and that was something that our organization worked very hard on, petitioned for that, and worked very hard on, so that as wolves, you know, recolonize the state from the north, from Oregon, that they get protections, so that they can survive and thrive here.
Do you feel, so it was 12 years ago, Shay, I guess 12 years ago or so, that you were a part of this petition that was filed to list the polar bear as endangered. Do you feel more optimistic or less optimistic now about the plight of endangered species?
Oh, you know, it kind of fluctuates. I I'm very frightened about the slow pace of action on climate change. As a scientist, I look at scientific studies on a daily basis, and there are thousands over the last decade that have just documented the incredible toll that climate change is taking on the planet, and the fact that if we don't do better in terms of greenhouse gas cuts to keep our carbon, keep temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius. We're already at 1 degree Celsius of global average temperature rise. If we don't, keep it around 1.5, that we are going to have very, very severe consequences. We've already, around the world, are experiencing very severe consequences with this, the Arctic ice cap, the Arctic sea ice, is half as extensive and half as thick as it was just a couple decades ago. Sea levels are rising and, inundating, Florida, for example, where I grew up. Florida's, coastal communities are getting inundated. We have extreme weather events are becoming more frequent, with heat waves and flooding. And so I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I am very worried about our future, and the future for wildlife on the planet because of climate change. And, I get up and do this job every day because I know that, a lot of people care and a lot of people will keep pushing for stronger action on climate change. And that's a key to protecting wildlife in this country. I think also people, at large really, a lot of people really care about wildlife. People don't want to see species go extinct. Many people are strong supporters of the Endangered Species Act and, protecting wildlife in this country, and that gives me hope. The next 4 years are very daunting, but I think that there are opportunities to try and stand up against the rollbacks that are coming, the rollbacks to our environmental protections, and there's hope and opportunity there, and I just hope that a lot of people can get involved and stand up.
What do you say and not say to your 5-year-old daughter about any of this?
Yeah, she loves critters. She loves them to her core. She loves owls. She loves bugs. She loves getting dirty. And, she knows what me and my husband, who's also an environmental activist, do for work. And she's concerned. She is concerned about wildlife, and she wants to see animals being protected. And so I try and talk to her. She's 5, so I don't want to scare her too much, but I also don't, I want to be honest. So I just say, with this election, for example, I said, Trump is a person who is going to try and roll back, a lot of the things that we care about. In my own way, civil rights, species protection, air and water protection. But we're going to stand up and fight, and we're going to push ahead and stand up for what's right, because that's the only thing that, we have to do that. That is the key thing that we have to do. And so just say a very, very simple kind of version of that to her. Mm-hmm. And she in her own way is, doing that. She in her own way is, very outspoken about, how much she loves animals and how much she wants to protect them. And that's really nice to see.
I think a lot of parents are probably dealing with this right now, where they don't want to scare their kids, but they want to be honest with their kids. And some people who are interested in issues like environmental protection and social justice, were genuinely afraid after the elections in November, and mm-hmm. trying to figure out how to play this. How you don't want to disempower your children. They can only handle so much information, or anyway, especially at the age of 5. So I think a lot of parents are really kind of grappling with that, how to talk to their kids about these things.
Yes, and a lot of, parents, are in situations where, they face real danger. There are a lot of people whose immigration status may be more uncertain, or, you know, who are, I think some people of color, you know, who feel very, very personally threatened. You know, as a woman, I, you know, very upset about someone who is a sexual predator becoming president of the United States. So people are feeling this very, very personally. And some people are in, you know, very clear and direct danger from this upcoming administration. And I think that this provides an incredible opportunity for people from all causes, from who are interested in social justice and environmental justice, to come together, form alliances, work with people that they may not have worked with before. I think there's a lot of common cause and a lot of opportunities for us to support each other.
Mm. So, Shay, let me paraphrase what I think is kind of at the core of what you were saying just a few minutes ago, and that is that you are essentially optimistic. You're optimistic about civic engagement. You're optimistic about the fact that you're not alone. There are many people who are interested in these types of issues. Many people with great ideas and boundless energy are working towards these types of issues. And that, you know, the arc is moving toward justice ever so slowly, but in the right direction. But at the same time, this is in the context and the backdrop of a planet that's warming, and that's not going to change, not in our lifetimes. That yes, culturally things are getting slowly better, but environmentally, nature isn't interested in our timeline. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that you've done a good job summarizing it. I mean, I think that we have done, just to add to that, a good job in environmental protection in terms of pushing back harms. I mean, we've really done under the Endangered Species Act and Clean Air and Clean Water Act, we've really, you know, done a lot to really improve the state of our air and water, and, you know, made some improvement on climate, but it's not been enough. When the environment deteriorates, everything is interconnected, and that affects all of us. And some people are more affected than others. There are many communities that are incredibly personally affected by the deterioration of our environment, and many wildlife species are directly impacted when they're losing their habitat. We're 7.5 billion people, and we have left very little for the millions of species we share the planet with, and that is not getting that much better. There's some strides made in that, but we need to do a lot more. So, I have a lot of hope because there has been a lot of positive change, and there are a lot of people that care, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Mm. Would you say that your optimism is genuine, real optimism, or would you say your optimism is strategic optimism because you know that pessimism doesn't help?
I would say both.
Yeah.
Play a part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Shay, also a little bit about the coral reef. What's the status
of coral reefs worldwide? Yeah, not good. They are suffering tremendously from climate change because the ocean's heating up, and corals are very sensitive to that. They undergo this process called bleaching when the waters, ocean waters, become too warm. And often after bleaching events where coral reefs lose their color, they get diseased or die. And also we have a phenomenon called ocean acidification happening also because of greenhouse gas pollution. You know, carbon pollution is entering the ocean, and it's making the ocean waters more acidic. And that acidity makes it harder for corals to build their skeletons, their protective, you know, shells. And so coral reefs worldwide, you know, are in crisis. I was at an international coral reef conference last summer, and coral reefs have been experiencing this global bleaching event that started in 2014 and went through 2016. And coral scientists after coral scientists that have spent decades studying corals gave talks about how they had seen this extreme bleaching and extreme mortality from the warm water event that was happening. One scientist who studied the Great Barrier Reef, you know, this beautiful, amazing reef system off Australia, his name's Terry Hughes, he said, I have never seen anything like this in my lifetime, and coral reefs will never be the same in our lifetime because the bleaching is and the mortality is going to be very long-lived. These corals are very long-lived, so when they die, it takes a long time for recovery. So, you know, for a key prominent scientist to say, you know, we're losing coral reefs and we're never going to have reefs, you know, these reefs back in our lifetime is really sobering. So, you know, that's, you know, it's coral reefs are, you know, the really core part of ocean diversity. You know, there's estimates there that 1/4 of marine species use coral reefs, you know, for food or for shelter. I mean, they are the rainforests of the ocean, and we are losing them. And that is another call to action for stronger greenhouse gas reduction, stronger carbon pollution cuts. We are losing too much. We are losing precious, irreplaceable things.
Well, what's good about this, I guess, is that from what you've said about the coral reefs and from what you've said about the wolverine and from what you've said about polar bears, we have one cause, one main cause, and that if we can deal with this idea of climate change, we can effectively deal with these, at least these three issues, and I'm sure there are more.
Yes, yes. I mean, if we can, in the United States...
And flooding. And I didn't even mention, were talking about the flooding of low-lying areas. And,
yes.
And there's a lot of people who live along the coast throughout the world.
Yeah, absolutely. In the United States and around the world, most people live along the coast. I think in the U.S. it's like 40% of the population lives in coastal counties.
Mm-hmm.
So sea level rise poses a tremendous threat, and there have been a lot of studies, you know, estimating the millions of Americans that will be displaced from rising sea levels within this century. And people are already experiencing flooding in many coastal communities, and we already have climate refugees.
Right.
So I don't know if people, you know, everybody knows this, but in Louisiana, in the Isle de Saint Charles, the people are relocating because their communities are getting drowned out by coastal subsidence and sea level rise. And in Alaska, Native Alaskans, communities like Kivalina and Shishmaref are having to relocate because of coastal erosion due to climate change. We already have climate refugees in this country.
In this country and around the world in other countries where folks are concerned about, oh, too many refugees are coming into our communities, there's going to be a whole lot more refugees coming into a lot of different communities if people can't live where they live. So that's four issues, right? Wolverines, polar bears, coral reefs, and flooding issues, all associated with climate change.
Yeah, and there's yes, absolutely, and there's even more, you know, heat waves, extreme weather events, mm-hmm. you know, including flooding like you mentioned, but also Atlantic hurricanes are becoming more powerful. You know, we saw in Hurricane Sandy the storm surge that came with that was devastating to mm-hmm. many parts of the coast, like Atlantic City.
You know, Shay, the first time I had a sense of the importance of climate change, when I really had a sense of it, was when I was talking with Paul Ehrlich from Stanford. And this is the man who wrote The Population Bomb and The Population Explosion and really put overpopulation on the map in the minds of many people. And I asked him, I said, Dr. Ehrlich, what do you think the greatest environmental challenges that we have to deal with today? And I asked him that question, and I almost wasn't even listening to his answer because I just knew he was going to say it's overpopulation. But he didn't. He said it was climate change. And when Dr. Paul Ehrlich, the population guru guy, makes that comment about climate change, that's enough to get people like me really, really listening.
Yeah, that, I'm glad for that. And, you know, the scientists that I work with, scientists across the world who are working on climate change are really frightened. And when scientists, in their work, they are, subdued in their publications, for example, they're kind of can be a subdued crowd, but they are frightened. They are really worried about the impacts of climate change that we're already seeing and the impacts that will come unless we take stronger action, to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. I mean, when you see scientists getting frightened, you really have to pay attention.
So we're just about out of time here, Shay, but let me wrap this back around to how we started this whole conversation. This conversation started with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service saying that the polar bears are in trouble in the Arctic, offering up a recovery plan, saying that one of the causes, in fact, the main cause of the problems that the polar bears are having is climate change. But not asking specifically to work with the EPA or other agencies in dealing with this particular issue. It makes a lot of sense. Is it too late for people to talk to the Fish and Wildlife Service now and say, how come the EPA, you're not asking for the help of the EPA? Is this too late? Is this a done deal with the recovery plan?
Yeah, the recovery plan is a final form, so there isn't any... forum for public comment on the plan. There was a public comment that happened a number of years ago, and a lot of people spoke out then, and the Fish and Wildlife Service still did not change. But I think even though there's no official public comment period, people should and can speak up, because recovery plans can get revised.
And beyond that, it is beyond the possibility of it being revised, it's also a great example of one of the problems that people are dealing with right now. And that's this idea of, when I say people are dealing with, I mean activists like yourself, where there are these piecemeal approaches to dealing with huge global issues.
Yeah, that's right. And, I think that people are concerned and about climate change and they want to speak up. I think, good places to start are talking to your friends and family. That's what I do. I have a father who, is a climate denier, and it's very difficult for me to talk to him. And I think that when people talk to their friends and family, their community members, and say, I'm concerned about this, other people pay attention. And they say, well, maybe I should be concerned about this too. Maybe I should learn about it and speak up about it. People often follow their neighbors. If no one's talking about it and no one's saying they're concerned, then everybody thinks, hey, maybe it's okay. So if you're concerned and
What do you say to dad?
Oh, what do I say? I try and present the facts about climate change, but it's not a rational decision for him. It's more of like a political kind of affinity group. I'm part of the Republican Party. That means I'm a climate denier. And I think people are starting to break out of that. I mean, I think people, as the evidence becomes more and more apparent, we look all around us and see the impacts, the footprint of climate change. I think people are less and less able to just deny its existence. And I think people also see, like my father, I think he sees the potential in clean energy and wind and solar and the, promise of moving to that, moving away from fossil fuels and moving to that. So I try a number of different approaches, and I don't know if any one works, but
this has turned into the conversation with Dr. Wolf about how she talks to her child and her father. But there's a lot to that, because these conversations, these important conversations about science and value, oftentimes need to start in the home.
I think so. I think it's, what we, yes, we need to talk about what's important to us and what we want to fight for and, the way we want the world to be. And I don't think anybody wants a world, that's in climate crisis, where fossil fuel industries continue to run amok and pollute our climate when we have, clean wind and solar that we can use. A world that works together to combat and stop climate change is a better you know, more beautiful, more livable world for everybody. And I think people know that.
So let me give you 1 minute, Shane, to talk to your dad. What are you going to say to him? Dad, start with that. Dad.
Oh gosh. Yeah, that's how I sound. I sound a little bit annoyed. So some of the you know, key is to call people in rather than call them out. You know, don't start by labeling them. You know, Dad, why are you such a climate denier? You know, it's like, Dad, you know, I'm really worried. You know, talk about, you know, my feelings. I'm really worried about, you know, what climate change, the climate crisis is doing to our planet and to the future for, you know, my daughter, for all of our kids, for all of us. And, you know, we don't have to go down this route. We can, you know, stop climate change by turning to clean energy and, you know, shifting from fossil fuels to, you know, clean energy jobs. That's good for all of us. And, you know, start off by saying something like that and see if I can get an opening to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the best of luck with you in terms of all of the really good work you're doing and the conversations that you're having with your family. Your husband's on your side. That's good.
Yeah, that's good. It's good to have community on your side. Mm-hmm. You know, these are very difficult and long-term fights. You know, they don't change overnight.
And I think it's important for people to remember that they're absolutely not in it alone. There's a lot of really good people doing a lot of really good work about these issues.
Absolutely.
Including Dr. Shay Wolf, Climate Science Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. Shay, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule. It was quite gracious of you to spend some time with us today.
Well, thank you, Randy. I really enjoyed talking with you. So thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Habitat.
Habitat.
Have to have a habitat. Habitat.
Habitat.
Have to have a habitat. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. You have to have a habitat to carry on. The ocean is a habitat, very special habitat. It's where the deepest water's at, where the biggest mammals at, where our future food is at, keeps the atmosphere intact. The ocean is habitat we depend on. Habitat.
Habitat.
Have to have a habitat. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. You have to have a habitat to carry on. The forest is a habitat, very special habitat. It's where the tallest trees are at, where a bear could scratch her back. Keeps the ground from rolling back, renews the oxygen. In fact, the forest is habitat we depend on. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. Habitat. Have to have a habitat. You have to have a habitat to carry on. Habitat, very special habitat. It's where the freshest water's at for people, fish, and muskrat. But when people dump their trash, rivers take the biggest rap. The river is habitat we depend on. People are different than foxes and rabbits. Affect the whole world with our bad habits. Better to love it while we still have it. Our rabbits. Habitat's gone. Habitat.
Habitat.
Have to have a habitat. Habitat.
As Bill Oliver with Habitat. It is 25 minutes before 1 o'clock. You're listening to KZFR Chico. My name is Randy Larson. This is the Peace and Social Justice Program, made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by The Printed Image, specializing in custom screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. They use the latest technology in their state-of-the-art building, and The Printed Image provides custom screen printing, embroidery, promotional products for business, organizations, or special events. For custom apparel and promotional products, The Printed Image has dedicated specialists providing quality service, quick turnaround, and memorable products. You can give them a call. It says here at 898-9525, 898-9525, or at the Printed Image Chico. .com, and also by the Disability Action Center, dedicated to gaining social and economic justice for people with disabilities. DAC can be reached by calling 893-8527 or www.actionctr.org, actionctr.org. With us on the telephone from Sacramento is Catherine Phillips, and Catherine is the director of Sierra Club, California, and I asked her if she would join us today to talk a little bit about Scott Pruitt, who is the man who is being nominated to head the Environmental Protection Agency by the Trump administration. Catherine, hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule. What do you think about Scott Pruitt? What do you think about this nomination? From everything that I've heard, he's not a big fan of the EPA.
No.
Interesting choice to be heading it up.
He is an interesting choice. I mean, he, on his own website, if you go and look for his website about, he's currently Attorney General in Oklahoma, he identifies himself as a leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda. I mean, he's basically not interested in protecting public health, not interested in making sure polluters clean up their mess. And if he's anything, he's a mouthpiece for the fossil fuel industry, the coal industry, the oil industry. He takes lots of money from those interests. He has aligned himself with them in activities in his roles in Oklahoma. I don't know that you could actually come up with a worse nominee for EPA.
Now, he sued the EPA to try to stop them from protecting children against mercury and neurotoxins.
Absolutely. And, he's gone after mercury protections. He's gone after protections. He tried to roll back and has led the charge on trying to roll back any new smog protections, and those smog protections are going to be extremely important to Californians all over this state, not just in some of the smoggiest portions, but, about 97% of Californians at some point, their community in any given year has bad air, and that doesn't meet federal national ambient air quality standards. So, he has a long history of going after all the things that the average Californian believes in. The average Californian, as all the polling shows, cares about clean air. They want their kids to be able to breathe. They want their neighbors' kids to be able to breathe. They want their coworkers' kids to be able to breathe. The majority of Californians want clean water. They don't want to have to worry about whether that water is contaminated. They don't want, Californians are notoriously bipartisan about their support for clean energy. They want renewable energy. And what Pruitt stands for is somebody who wants to put roadblocks in front of renewable energy, advance the coal industry's agenda, not do anything to even to make any of these dirty industries clean up their act, and promote policies that will put children, adults, wildlife, you name it, to put any living creature in harm's way.
You know, before we chatted with you this afternoon, Catherine, we talked with a woman named Shay Wolf. I don't know if you're familiar with Shay, but she works with the Center on Biological Diversity. And she was talking about the polar bear recovery plan that the Fish and Wildlife Service had just put out on Monday. And the Fish and Wildlife Service says, look, the number one problem associated with the demise of the polar bear is climate change. We're not going to be able to help the polar bears unless we do something about their loss of habitat. But we have here Scott Pruitt, a man as recently as May was saying that the debate is far from settled in terms of climate change. Is it fair to say that Scott Pruitt, the potential head of the EPA, is a climate science denier?
I think that's fair to say. He has been part of an effort to challenge to defend ExxonMobil, and ExxonMobil has been under investigation and challenged for its climate record, but it's also been challenged for denying climate science in how it does its business, even as its executives understood that their product was creating climate change. So, you know, the way you get at climate change is you shift the country away from fossil fuels. And the way you get at clean air is that you shift the country away from fossil fuels. So even if he's a climate denier, he still has an obligation to protect public health. And there's no indication that he will protect public health. And a lot of the things that he would have to do to protect us from climate change would also be the things he would have to do to protect public health. And he's not, there is no indication he will do those things. And those things mean going after and cleaning up the energy sector by making sure that coal-fired power plants are not spewing mercury, to make sure that we're transitioning away to transitioning to cleaner fuels. And the one way you do that is to make sure you set the standards so that you get less and less and less pollution over time. And he's been fighting every effort to do that.
So we're talking with Catherine Phillips, director of the Sierra Club, California. Catherine, how much turnover is there at the EPA when the new administration comes in? Do you know?
I don't know in a number sense, but what I do know is that career EPA people have in the past, when they've had miserable leaders come in who've been appointed, and that has happened in the past, career EPA people have generally stuck it out. And they've tried to manage as best they can, mm-hmm. because they are committed to the mission. Mm-hmm. People don't go into environmental science because they want to make sure that polluters continue to pollute. Mm-hmm. They go into these environmental jobs because they want to make sure that public health is protected. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's going to be a massive turnover in EPA employment. I do think there will be some shifting around of leaders. And one of the things that does happen, and academics who've looked at what's happened, and what we saw when Ronald Reagan came in and brought in some less than stellar leadership at EPA, one of the things that does happen is that that new people will join the agency, but they'll be joining the agency with a different ethic. They'll be joining the agency because they want to follow the leadership of whoever the secretary is. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate thing here is that we're likely to get a generation or 4 years at least of applicants coming to EPA, in which not all, but a significant number will be less committed to protecting public health and may be more aligned with the interests of industry.
So we
could have a legacy situation here.
So, you know, people like you that are that do this work full time, I mean, it's got to be just a blow to the stomach when you find out that somebody like Scott Pruitt could be nominated to the EPA. But at least you're not working in the EPA. Imagine what it might be like for some of these people that have an entirely different value system and have followed their value system to work with the EPA. And now they have a person with a totally different value system being nominated to head it up. It seems like those people, those EPA workers and those people that are working in the Interior Department, those people working with the Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service, those good people, boy, they really need our support. They need thank you letters and encouragement not to quit. To hang in there, to try to affect change from the inside, that's got to be tough for some of those folks.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think it has become too common and too easy for Americans to cynically degrade government workers. But my experience is that, at least in our state, that people who work at agencies, even if you disagree with them, their commitment to the work they're doing, the professional staff, the scientists, the people who develop regulations, the people who are answering the phones at these agencies all the way through, they're committed to the mission. And these environmental agencies, their mission is to protect the public and to protect the natural resources that we have in this country that are so valuable. And the value goes beyond dollar valuable. You can't replace the air that is cleaned by the forest. You can't replace the function of a forest. These are really valuable services that nature provides. So, you know, I think it's going to be very hard for the people who work there. But I just think also the people who work there are going to be so committed that they'll find a way to manage. And they may also feel like it's their responsibility to the next generation. And this is what I've seen among friends who've been in agencies and that have gone through turmoil. It's their responsibility to the next generation to make sure that somebody is there to speak for that next generation. And I suspect you'll find that's going to be true of a lot of the EPA employees.
Do you think California is in a somewhat different position than the rest of the country in terms of the effects of the Trump administration?
Well, you bet. I mean, we have fantastic, on this issue, on the issue of response to Trump, we have fantastic leadership in the state legislature, and the governor has been very strong on the environmental issues, on the climate change issue, and has pushed back and been very bold about the things he has said about the Trump administration. But the day after
and
the election,
as was Schwarzenegger, the last Republican governor, he was pretty good on climate change.
Yes, he was too. And Jerry Brown is good on climate change. And, you know, and Gray Davis before Schwarzenegger was good on climate change. We have a bipartisan world in California where Republicans and Democrats recognize that we have to protect the environment. But what we really have here, too, is we're in the right place at the right time. We have a Senate pro tem, a leader of the Senate in Kevin DeLeon, who is committed to addressing climate change and some of the other issues that Trump has already raised. Senator DeLeon is committed to social justice, to immigrant rights, to civil rights, and to addressing climate change. Likewise with Speaker Rendon. He's committed to all of those things, and they've been working very closely together. And if your listeners haven't seen it, they should look it up online. It's not hard to find now, but the two put out a joint statement the day after the election, making it very clear that California is going to continue to pursue a just and fair society that addresses issues like climate change. They're not going to be intimidated by Trump, and they're going to do everything in their power to make sure that Californians are protected and to be a shining light for the rest of the country. They've hired Eric Holder to be their attorney. They rarely do this. The legislature rarely goes out and hires an outside counsel to help them, but they have hired Holder and his firm to help, to counsel them.
So Eric Holder is the former Attorney General of the United States.
Right, on how to respond, or better than respond, even how to proactively make sure that California is able to continue its march to improve the environment, to protect us from climate change, and to also protect our residents.
I wonder if California will end up becoming a bit of a model for other states.
I mean, it already is in a number of areas, and the one I know about best is in the environmental policy. It is a model and a leader for states around the country, but also for nations around the world. So I think we will again have to just sort of buckle down and be stronger leaders. And, you know, I know in the advocacy community, we have about a year ago started a very, or we were part of a very overt group of progressive lobbyists and progressive organizations that got together about a year ago, and we have been collaborating and meeting regularly. And at that point, we didn't know that we would be facing Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But now we know we've worked with each other for more than a year. We know each other, and we're helping each other on those issues that don't look that cross over into everybody's lives. Mm-hmm. The Sierra Club now is helping our allies who work on health access, because we recognize that as long as we have polluted cities, as long as people are threatened with polluted water, you need good access to good health care. Everybody needs access to health care to thrive under those poor environmental circumstances.
I remember, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, we know that people who live in the shadows, people who are afraid because they're afraid they're going to be discriminated against because they have a particular religion, because they're LGBT, because they are of a particular race. Anybody who feels they have to live in the shadows under a Trump administration, they're going to be less able to fully participate in civic engagement, which is the foundation. Civic engagement is the foundation of environmental activism. So we want to make sure,
and democracy.
Not just because it's right. I mean, it's social justice is the right thing. Civil rights is the right thing. But there's a solid, logical reason that any environmental group will embrace social justice right now, because you simply can't have a clean environment if you have people that
are huddled on the sidelines, that are afraid to get involved. Yeah, it's the cornerstone of democracy. If we wanted a philosopher king, we could have gone in a different direction.
Exactly.
I remember in 1992 when Clinton and Gore came into the White House, and Al Gore was seen as such a progressive at the time that the actual numbers, the membership numbers for the Sierra Club dropped. And in part, the thinking was that it was this view that, oh, okay, we now have somebody who is deeply committed to our issues in the White House, and so we don't have to try as hard. We don't have to work as hard. Al Gore will be able to take care of it for us. I remember that. And I'm wondering if the opposite has happened or is about to happen for the Sierra Club now. Do you see increased numbers of people getting involved in the club?
Yes. Well, you know, we have our membership has increased. I can't tell you by how much. I don't have that off the top of my head, but I know from staff meetings with our national office that our membership has increased. Immediately after the election, we were getting a lot of inquiries about how can we help, how can we be, how can we support your effort. I know personally, I get calls and emails from people thanking the club for being there and helping at what is viewed by many as a very difficult time. You know, in the past, as you noted, the when things look like they're going well for the environment, people tend not to join environmental organizations. They get busy with other things. They don't feel like they have to be vigilant. But we have seen in the past when Ronald Reagan came in, when Bush 2 came in, we will see bump ups in membership, and we're seeing a bump up now. But I think every environmental group and environmental justice group is seeing a bump up in interest. People are worried.
Catherine, I want to make a pitch for volunteer coordinators. I think volunteer coordinators are perhaps the single most important position in environmental organizations, because you get people, especially around this time of year, who have maybe made a New Year's resolution. They've had enough. Finally, they're going to get off their duff. They're going to get off the couch. They're going to get involved. They've been talking about it for years. Darn it, I'm going to call the Sierra Club or whomever they focus on. I'm going to call them and I'm going to get involved, and they tell their friends and they tell their family and they make the call, and somebody on the other end of the line says, yeah, we'll get back to you, you know, when we have something for you to do. And they're just, and that's it. And all of this passion and all of this energy and all of whatever happened to get that to happen in the first place is now lost. And the person, they can tell their friends and family and, you know, the other part of themselves, yeah, I made the phone call, blah, 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 but there was just nothing for me to do. And I think that when people make that call and want to get involved, there needs to be somebody there to really channel their energy in a positive way so that they can feel that they're helping, because they need that feeling.
The interesting thing about Sierra Club is that it's based on volunteerism. So the local chapters are run by volunteers, and all somebody has to do is go online and go to sierraclub.org, and then work your way through the tabs, and you'll find a link to that will show you a map with links to the local chapters, and you can go to their websites for the local chapter and find out when they're having a meeting and show up. And by the end of the meeting, you'll probably be running a committee. Don't mean to scare people away, but if you don't want to run a committee, you don't have to. But
right.
you can be as involved or as you want, as much or as little. And it's up to volunteers to run it. So you don't just make a call and find out what you can do. You just show up and
get to work.
And work and do the work.
Catherine, thank you for all the really good work that you're doing. Let me give you 30 seconds to give people the pitch of how we can do it. Pitch how we can get it done. Pitch.
Well, first of all, don't lose faith. There is power in numbers, and California has a lot of numbers. And right now is the time to, what I would suggest is to get to know who your local legislator is, who your legislator is that comes to Sacramento, and tell that legislator you want to make sure that they're voting for the environment and with the environment when they do their work in Sacramento and the state capitol, because it's going to make a difference to the rest of the world. What California does now, it's going to be the one light in what can be otherwise a grim several years.
Catherine Phillips, director of Sierra Club California, very gracious of you to take time out of your busy schedule and talk with us today. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Chico Downtown Business Association, supporting downtown Chico for over 40 years now. CDBA brings you the Thursday Night Market, Friday Night Concert Series, Taste of Chico, Christmas Preview, Tree Lighting, Tree Street, and so much more. Thank you to the Downtown Chico Business Association for supporting community radio. And also by Chico Performances, presenting award-winning Las Cafeterias on Thursday, February the 9th at 7:30. Hailing from L.A., Las Cafeterias remixes Latin-based roots music with modern-day stories using hip-hop, beat, cumbia, punk, and rock played on traditional instruments. If you'd like more information or tickets, you can check out chicoperformances.com. And finally, big thank you to Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, producers of fine beers and ales. Sierra Nevada also offers fine dining at their tap room and restaurant at 1075 East 20th Street in Chico. For more information, www.